Okay.
All right.
Mr. Arnold, thank you so much for joining me today.
Of course.
I'm joining whoever is watching. For the moment, it's Sean.
Hi, Sean.
Thank you so much, Sean. And so, man, look, you really helped me a lot for almost 2 years now. And there are some specific angles that I would like to discuss with you today, because they're very it's very helpful to me, and hopefully it will help a guy or two watching this.
Yeah.
And for me, what really hit me is if most of the time that I see you in your kitchen in Cincinnati, you're making coffee for your wife in the morning.
Right.
Man.
Well, that's because, you know, the meeting is at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning for me, and it's nine in the evening for you in Singapore. So my day is getting started, and I make coffee for my wife every morning, because when we lived in Singapore, she would take a car into work, of course, and a taxi into work, and there was a Starbucks at the bottom of her building, and that was her breakfast every morning, venti mocha, right? And that allowed her to, you know, start her day. And when the pandemic hit, all the Starbucks in Cincinnati closed. I mean, even, you know, drive-throughs, all those things, they were just closed. And so we did what you do, and you check YouTube, you know, how do you make a Starbucks mocha?
Yeah.
And so I researched a couple of recipes, played around with it, and I got it so that my wife prefers my coffee over Starbucks. So be careful what you wish for. And I didn't know that I would spend the pandemic doing this every day for my wife. But, you know, as we were talking about earlier, you know, what is love? You know, love, is it a noun? Is it a word? Is it a verb? For me, it's easier for me to access these abstract concepts through action. And for me, making that coffee for my wife is just one of the basic ways that I express my love for her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's, you know, when you mentioned this, that reminds me when I was a kid, man, when I was 10, when it was the weekend, I would try to prepare breakfast for my parents. And, you know, my mom is a coffee drinker, and I would, you know, prepare the coffee for her. I don't know how many, you know, it was like coffee makers, like in the US, you know, with the filter and stuff. And I would put, you know, spoons of coffee powder, and then I would take a bit of cocoa powder to add with that. And I don't know if it was too much coffee for her, but she liked it. I was doing that on Saturdays. And mocha is that, right? Mix of coffee and cocoa.
Coffee and chocolate, cocoa, yeah. Some kind. Yeah. Yeah.
There is this guy, his name is Adrian, obviously, hopefully we'll be on the pod at some point as well. But he told me that I can't pretend loving somebody if I don't love myself enough. And so it's an act of love that you do here. So how did you get there? How did you move to loving yourself enough
I think that for me, it was easier to show love to other people than to myself, because where I started was, you know, from a place of really a lot of self-loathing, because, you know, the person I was 20 years ago was not a very likable person. Mm-hmm. And not because I was flawed in some fundamental way, but because my actions weren't very esteemable. And when you've been that way for a long time, you start to think that that is you, that is your identity. And it's hard to move from self-loathing to self-love. For me, it began by being able to show love and express love to other people first. And I think that paved the way for me to start, you know, maybe self-love, the journey towards self-love. You don't go from self-loathing to self-love. For me, I had to go from self-loathing to acceptance, to accept the person who I am right now as being exactly who I need to be in that moment. Mm. Because I've always felt like I was not enough. And to be reminded that I'm a beautiful child of God, that I am perfect as I am in this moment, was a very difficult concept for me.
Mm-hmm. And you know, for someone who's there right now, you know, with that self-loving thing, and to make it more concrete, and because the thing is that, you know, I I used to want, and I know a lot of people still want, you know, a quick fix, an easy one, right? Even a box of pills, if it exists, you know, to change the whole thing. Because everybody talks about loving yourself, you know?
Right.
So what is the, what did you do, man? How did you, and for how long did you do it? How long did it take?
You know? I'm telling you, that low self-esteem, that self-loathing, that, you know, active drug use and alcohol use is a very dark and lonely place. And, you know, I'm talking about years, maybe a decade, where, you know, my behavior just, what is it, my behavior deteriorated faster than I could lower my standards, you know? Yeah. I thought I'm never going to do this, and all of a sudden I was here before I even knew it. And the journey from self-loathing to self-love, well, how do you build self-esteem, right? Well, the same way that you destroyed it, you know, by taking these actions that you weren't very proud of, but feeling powerless sometimes over that. That journey starts with, how do you build self-esteem? Well, by doing the opposite of what you were doing before, by doing esteemable acts, you know, by almost by showing yourself that you're not the person you used to be because you act differently. It might not have changed a lot in your head because it's difficult for us to see ourselves the way the world perceives us. So all I can go on is, what are my observable, concrete actions? What am I doing in the material world? Because I live in my head, but I exist in the world, right? And so these little acts of service, of love, of making coffee for my wife every day, that's an act of love. What is self-love? Self-love, probably for me, the most spiritual thing I do in the evening is set my alarm for the time I need to get up the next morning. Because I have this thing, let's say it starts at 8, that means I have to get up at, let's say, 6:30, because I need to do, you know, some things that have been very beneficial on my journey towards spiritual growth.
Yeah.
You know, prayer, meditation, just spending quiet time with myself. I don't know if you've ever had this feeling when you awaken, it feels like your head has been up a half hour before you
did. Yeah, like a radio playing in the background.
Right.
Yeah,
and so what that quiet time in the morning helps me to do is to align, you know, where my head is and where my body is. You know, by taking that quiet time, we can meet there and then approach our day. And it gives me an opportunity for some mindfulness and some direction. So I'm not wasting my energy, you know, spinning my wheels. Because if you don't know where you're going, it's really hard to get there.
Yeah.
You know, that's, what is it, the good news, bad news joke? You know, the bad news is, you know, we're lost. Well, what's the good news? Well, we're making really good time. You know, I mean,
Yeah. For me, like, I'm trying to absorb and, you know, trying to relate. Was there some decisive milestones, you know, in this thing where you realize that, you know, you look at the guy in the mirror and you don't hate him so much anymore. And then later you look at the guy in the mirror and you start recognizing a friend. I had moments like this. And then I look at the guy in the mirror and then I started thinking, I want to look at his hair now. I want to see what his hair looks like when he's getting longer. Right. You know, and it was, you know, for me, that there's been that progression recently. You know, my hair looks a bit stupid today because I'm still experimenting. And for you, how was it? Because for me, I've just started, right? And
it's interesting that you say looking in the mirror, because honestly, there were years where I could not look above my nose in the mirror. I only looked in the mirror long enough to shave. Yeah. I never met my own eyes in the mirror because I was ashamed of that person. And I don't know where my eyes were able to meet my own eyes in the mirror. But it's, you know, it's one of those things that just working towards that. And I don't know when it happened. Well, let's say in the recovery circles. If you've been abstinent for a time and then you relapse, or you drink again, you use drugs again, one of the kind of sayings is, you know, relapse is a process, not an event. And I think that's true of so many things. Recovery is a process, not an event.
Mm.
You know, when does that magic moment happen when you are free of, you know, the bedevilments that have plagued you for a year, maybe decades? Some people come to that moment in kind of a bright light, burning bush, as they say, moment. And for some people, it's a gradual educational process. And it's hard to pinpoint an exact time or date because, you know, being in the process, again, you're not aware of your progress. I think it's easier sometimes for other people to detect those changes in you than it is to really be aware that, you're changing. And they're going on your behavior. So you start behaving differently.
Yeah. There is this guy that reminds me, this guy, Mark, good friend of mine. Yeah, he was saying it's like, you know, it's like back in London in the 19th century where they were using whale oil for the public, you know, lighting. And you are there, you're on the street, and you are lighting them one by one. And for you, it's monotone, and you don't know what, you don't really see any progress, right? But if you get on top of Big Ben, then you can see all those streets that are being lit up, you know? And that's what it makes me think of. For me, for example, I had a few big jumps, big differences. For me, it was when, like, part of my recovery, when I help some guys, you know, like, for example, go to the hospital or something like that, and I realized I could be here for someone. And in the past, you know, in my relationships, and that's why we're talking about your Mrs. Wright today, and because for me, I couldn't be here for any woman that I said I loved. And the first time I was able to be here for somebody, for real, it was some dude I didn't know and I didn't want to be with.
Right.
You know? But just being here, man, just being here, you know, when I went back home, I was like, holy shit, I did this, you know, as in I'm capable to do that, you know, and now I know what it's like. And so for me, it was very, it was one of those big moments when I felt a big shift. And there is a part of me that is scared, you know, that, you know, I can go back to the old stuff, you know, of being, you know, here without being here, you know, and, I don't want to make a coffee for you this morning,
right?
Because you haven't done much for me lately,
right?
You know, what's your
now that you mention it, there is a time in my early recovery where my spiritual advisor, my sponsor, and I made plans to go to a convention in Toronto, Canada, and we were traveling separately, meeting there. In my driving up there, I stopped to see a friend in Cleveland on the way from where I was living in Cincinnati, and we went out to an amusement park with his sister and her children. And during that day at the park, I lost my wallet. And so I didn't have any money, didn't have any credit cards, didn't have any ID. My friend lent me $100, and this is, you know, almost 20 years ago when $100 was like real money. And then we got to my mom's house. Fortunately, we were close by. I was able to get my social security card, birth certificate, get a new driver's license, and then drive to Toronto. When I got up there, my sponsor lent me, you know, hundreds of dollars. And he said, just, you know, pay me back, you know, every week a little bit until you're paid off. And then, you know, after a few months, when I finally paid him the last little bit that I borrowed from him, I'm like, yeah, I really, thanks for the loan. I wasn't sure I was going to pay you back, you know, because I mean, I wasn't really trustworthy, or so I thought. But he said, I knew you would. So he had seen that change in me before I was aware of it in myself, that I could be trusted, that I was a man of my word, that I had personal integrity. And I thought that those things weren't a part of my makeup anymore, or were never a part of my makeup. And so that's how the world tells me that I'm changing. I don't see it, but, you know, I have to be kind of maybe made aware of it, you know, through other people.
And there was Yeah, for me, the way I live it is that there are some good news and bad news. The bad news is that it's not something that's done and then it stays permanently.
Mm.
That's the bad news. But the good news is that...
Oh, that's also the good news.
Yeah, that's also the good news. The good news is that doing what it takes to keep it,
right,
is fucking awesome, you know? It's helping people. It's literally, it's being, you know, I don't know why, this David Bowie song now.
Mm.
You can be hero just for one day, you know?
Yeah.
We can be hero just for one day. And
right. Well, that's yeah, as long as we're able to be sober or clean. Yeah. Because we can't predict the future. All we can do is what's in front of us. So yeah, I love that. We can be heroes just for one day.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, it's like swimming basically, you know. I need to move, I need to do those things, you know, because otherwise I'm drowning back to the old stuff. And that's, you know, I've done enough of it. Mm. And I don't want to continue doing that, you know. And for me, you know, I'm at a stage now where I'm thinking about, you know, love on the outside, you know, and for me, I realize that it's something for me that is so new, you know. There is this thing, right? I'm like, you know, I didn't know what self-love meant, and I'm discovering what it is now. And so that means that I have no idea what loving somebody else is.
Mm.
How did it work for you? How did you realize?
I think for me, again, any kind of love is an action, including and most importantly, self-love. What is self-love begin with? It begins with self-care. Mm-hmm. What is self-care? Easy. It's taking care of your physical, biological needs so that you have a good baseline to work from.
Mm-hmm.
One of the acronyms, one of the many irritating acronyms in recovery is HALT, H-A-L-T.
Mm-hmm.
Never let yourself get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired.
Mm.
It seems very basic, but you know, if I'm any of those or all four of those, I'm not capable of making good decisions.
Mm.
I get away from the rational self and move towards the emotional self.
Mm-hmm.
So I make sure that I eat regularly. That's the hungry part.
Mm-hmm.
You'd think it would be easy, but you know, I suffered sometimes from workaholism, where you know, working and making money seemed to be the most important thing. And I would skip meals or forget to eat. And that led to, you know, there's a word actually, hangry, H-A-N-G-R-Y, that went into the dictionary a few years ago to recognize that, you know, if you don't eat, you can get quite cranky. And so, yeah, that's the hungry, which leads you to angry, hungry, right? And again, What are the things you can do in the material world to make yourself not angry? Well, for me, getting good rest, getting good food, that puts me in a better physical state. So when something comes at me, I'm not already in a disturbed state that I'm going to react to it. So I make sure that I get enough sleep. You know, like I said, going to bed at a regular time, getting up at a regular time, that goes to the tea and tired. And then lonely. You know, I've been the kind of guy that could be lonely in a room full of people.
Yeah.
Because I'm not allowing myself to be vulnerable.
Mm.
And I'm not allowing people to see who I really am. And I think that's where they say that the opposite of addiction is connection, right? I think I actually heard that from you. That's a Nassim quote, everyone.
From Keith in Melbourne.
Yeah. But, you know, being vulnerable first allows other people to be vulnerable in your presence, right? Being honest first allows people to be honest in your presence.
Mm-hmm.
So modeling or showing that behavior allows people to feel safe in your presence. And I think that's, you know, that's the key to a lot of this, is that I have to almost do it within myself first. And then people will feel comfortable, you know, being that way with me. So self-love, self-care comes first and foremost. And I learned that both in the recovery programs, but, you know, I trained. I went back to school to get my master's in social work. Mm. And I was a mental health therapist at a women's residential rehabilitation facility in Cincinnati, Ohio. Mm. And in the social work program, two of the most important concepts were self-care mm-hmm. and boundaries. And I was mm. not good at either one of those
yeah.
Before I got in recovery. And even after recovery, I had to really learn it. And what does that mean? And I think that most people could benefit from self-care. I mean, who wouldn't? Mm. And from boundaries. And boundaries is just, protecting yourself so that your energy, that your focus isn't dissipated, because there are things out there that will suck these things out of you, mm. leaving you none for yourself. And it's like the oxygen mask in an airplane. Mm. You know, they always tell you to put your oxygen mask on first mm-hmm. before you help somebody with theirs. So you have to make sure your recovery has enough air, has enough oxygen, mm. because you can't pass on something that you don't have.
Yeah. And this idea of passing something that you have, I mean, because in the past, you know, like I was in relationships, but I was using these relationships to stop hurting. I was using these relationships to find purpose, you know, to make future palatable, you know. Basically, I was using, and these relationships, man, I really hurt people. And at what point in your basically, and if it's personal, it's okay. We don't need to talk about it. But without saying her name, you know, like your wife, man, how did you know that this is not, you are not using? You are truly in love with this person, and now you want to be with her. You know what I mean? Because done this work. And
it's interesting, because when we started dating and we started getting a little bit more serious,
yeah.
and I floated the idea of getting married to her. And
you floated the idea.
Well, because I like being in monogamous relationships. Mm-hmm. I like being married. And she asked me, well, what's in it for me, basically? That's not what she
nice.
Said, because she's actually a nice person. But the gist of it was, you know, I'm doing really well on my own, and she was doing perfectly well without me. What is the upside of being married to you?
Wow.
And my answer was, and it just came out of my mouth, because I'm creative and I have a lot of love to give. And until I said that, I didn't know it was true. Right?
Wow. Okay.
And so by her asking me that, uh-huh. you know, I didn't know that the answer was there until it came out of my mouth. And we both looked at it on the table and went, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, that's a great answer. Where did that come from? It came from all those years of doing that work, right? So that it was there and when I needed it and to call it forth. I didn't realize that, you know, a lot of the stuff that I do is, you know, creative. It may not be like writing a book or, painting a picture.
Mm-hmm.
But I was using, you know, my God-given abilities to create, you know, to create. And if that meant creating my life, creating my day, creating a relationship, it's a creative act. It's a physical manifestation in the material world of an abstract concept, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a lot of love to give. I didn't realize that until I said it. But as soon as I said it, I knew that was true. I knew that there was a lot of love in me that needed to be expressed. And by giving it out in the world, you know, that's how it comes up in me. That was my journey to self-love. It didn't start with me.
Mm.
It starts by giving love. And I think that's the way I was kind of accessing it for myself. And again, it goes back to that point of how do you build self-esteem by doing esteemable acts? And that's it, right? The way that I destroyed my self-esteem on a daily basis by degrading and disappointing myself every day,
yeah.
I built my self-esteem by showing myself through my actions that I could be consistent, that I could be loyal, that I could be loving, that I could be faithful. I didn't know I could do those things until I did them. That's all my wife has ever known me as. And that's really cool, because if I were to do otherwise, it would be me choosing to be disloyal, unfaithful, unloving. And I don't want to do that. And given the choice today, I would not choose otherwise. I've heard sometimes that recovery is creating a life where there's nothing for drugs or alcohol to fix.
Nothing to escape from.
To escape from, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to be anywhere else than where I am right now. I don't want to be anybody else than I am right now. And that is such a far cry from the person that I was 20 years ago, when I was using drugs and alcohol to escape my situation, and mainly to escape myself, because my actions over a period of years, I hated the person I had become. I really did. And I didn't know that there was a way out. And again, that's the power of recovery. It is a spiritual solution to a spiritual malady. I was trying to fix a spiritual malady in the material world by using drugs, alcohol, food, you name it, books I used to escape when I was a child. I didn't know that's what I was doing. I always thought I was just a reader and I liked books. But before I knew about drugs or alcohol, I was using this as, a child to escape where I was, because I wasn't comfortable being me. And, you go to the library and boom, you got your escape there. So I actually blame libraries for my drug and alcohol problem. So defund the libraries.
Yeah, libraries should ban libraries.
Exactly.
that resonates with me a lot. My mom reconnected with a friend of hers that she hasn't seen since 1994, for 30 years, and that friend asked her about me and stuff. And she said, she asked her, does he still make that sound? And my mom said, what do you mean? She said, don't you remember when, basically when I was a kid, I was always, reading those comic books, like Tintin, for example. Her son had he was my best friend at the time. His name is Dimitri. He had the whole collection of the Tintin comics, And I was always reading like that. And she would ask me a question. And I would be like, basically I was completely shutting everything off. And I use relationships for that. I really did, man. The dreamed love story for me, that was an intense obsession, very short-lived. I would burn the candle from both ends, and then
be surprised when the lights went out.
And then the real person is here in front of me, and she's wondering what's going on, because that's not literally it's gone now.
Right, because you weren't in love with the person, you weren't in love with the concept of being in love, so it didn't matter who the person was. You were after this feeling. Yeah, it's a thing, man. It's living in the real world is hard. It's not for everyone, That's why drug companies and liquor companies and Facebook and Netflix and all these companies are so successful, because they give us an opportunity and an easy way to escape who we are and where we are. And, are we really living? We're alive, but are we living? It's difficult. And I'm afraid that it's getting more difficult, because, there's so many more distractions. It's disturbing to me. Every Sunday I get a little summary of my screen time for the week and what it averages during the day. It's horrific. Yeah. But, what do we do? And so I try to do the best I can every day and leave it go at that.
And, you are the second person telling me this in less than a week now. There is Tom at work, he told me about this. Yeah, like, you know, yeah, being in love with the concept of being in love, not with the real person. So when you met your wife, how did you know you were not doing this, basically? You know what I mean?
Well, that's another interesting question. When just in my life and relationships with women, it goes feast and famine. I'll go for a while without being, you know, in a relationship, and then I'll meet someone, and then I'll meet someone else, and I'll meet someone else, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm dating a couple of different women. So in my early recovery, I went through a couple of years of famine, and then the first relationship I was in was very unhealthy because it was based on my self-centeredness and self-seeking. Surprisingly, it did not go well. But the lessons I learned in that failed relationship allowed me to do the work on myself to identify what I wanted in an ideal relationship. Because my feelings had been hurt. I wrote down faithfulness, unconditional love, loyalty. I shared this with a friend and he says, "So you want a dog?" Yeah. I said, "That's no." But I said, how do I find that in a relationship? He said, by being that person in a relationship, and that's what you'll attract. And, you know, I didn't realize that I'd kind of like put that in the back of my mind. It'd been sitting there for a while. And, you know, I'm doing what we do. And I met this woman that was initially more interested. Well, she was interested in me, but I didn't know it. I was waiting tables in a restaurant, and she became one of my regulars. She would come in every week with her best friend or another one of her friends, asked to sit at one of my tables. And I used to be in the wine business and the hospitality business. So, you know, she'd ask me for wine recommendations, and I was more than happy to help her. And this happened, you know, week after week for about 4 months. And I didn't realize it because, again, you don't expect your, you know, your customers to be interested in you in that way. And I would never do that anyway. That's what hostesses are for. Sorry, that was a joke. you know, those hostesses in the restaurants, there's a reason they put the pretty girls in the front. Yeah. Anyway, attractive young women, I'm sorry. In the front. We'll fix that in post, right? And she had kind of stalked me. I think that's what the technical term is, for 4 months until her best friend got tired of eating at that restaurant. She said, if I have to eat another artichoke-crusted chicken, I'm just going to punch somebody in the throat. So she made me call this woman that would become my wife up, and we've been together ever since. Now, when we first started dating, I was in one of my feast modes. And so I was dating a couple of other women, including a young hostess at a restaurant that I was working in. And on my way to have a late date, you know, because in the restaurant business, you finish up and then you get together for drinks or whatnot. And I was into the whatnot. On the way to meet her for my date, I passed a restaurant that had a tapas dinner, T-A-P-A-S. It's a Spanish small plate dinner, not topless, because that's a whole other restaurant. So I thought, you know, this woman would be really interested in that because we have an affinity for food and dining and that kind of thing. And I realized that if I'm on my way on a date with some 20-something-year-old cute hostess, but I'm thinking about somebody else, maybe I should pay attention to that. And I'd always had an idea of what I wanted in women, and it was much more superficial. And then I realized that those qualities that I'd put down on paper that I was looking for in a relationship were all there in her. That and more. So this woman was more than I ever could have imagined in a partner, because my imagination isn't that good. You know, she's got the most strong self of self and in personal integrity. You know, not just like cash register honesty, where you're not going to steal from a cash register. Mm. But how she treats people in the world, she's a much, much nicer, kinder, tolerant, gentler person than I am. And it's very inspiring and occasionally irritating to have that around you all the time, because I used to take offense of it because it made me look bad. Well, that didn't make me look bad. My actions made me look bad. Mm. And so I've learned to, you know, kind of like, oh, you know, people wear those, used to be a thing, you know, what would Jesus do? You know, what would my wife do in this situation? She would probably compliment them on their shoes or their dress or their, she has this way of disarming people and making them like her, but in a genuine way, not in the manipulative, what's in it for me way that I used to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's, okay, now I'm trying to get this, right? And I'm obviously I can't quit my job and try to become a waiter somewhere and wear very tight jeans, you know.
That's a part of it, of course, yes.
That's very interesting when you tell me that, you know, feast and famine. I remember my therapist was telling me about that, you know, phases of anorexia and bulimia. And he was telling me that I was doing this for everything. I was doing that with food, I was doing that with relationships, I was doing that with dating. And I haven't been doing that, man, for like very long time now, for a year and a half. And so I second guess myself sometimes. I'm like, isn't it the longest period of anorexia ever? But on the other hand, there is nothing I'm trying to run away from. You know, I like my life now.
Yeah.
Like literally. And that's so that's something, you know, that when I listen to your story, it gives me hope. But also, I'm still wondering, you know, like, I mean, you also give me the signals, you know, on what to look for. Like that example that you gave, right? You go on a date with somebody, but then you think about this woman and you pay attention to that thought.
So, yeah, to that intuitive thought, that feeling comes from my gut. And, you know, a lot of times because it didn't align with what I thought I wanted, I ignored it because what I wanted, what I thought was good for me, what I thought I wanted, sometimes really isn't. You know, it's like the quick fix. It's like the difference between character building and taking the easier, softer way. Because, you know, doing things the easy way doesn't build character. You know, the tension between convenience and character building. Rarely is the most convenient action or decision in a time, rarely is that the one that leads to building character. You know, I mean, studying is boring, it's tedious, but the people that do it on a regular basis, they're often more successful because the process of doing that, the self-discipline, the self-sacrifice that it takes to do that, that's what builds character. That's when you're showing yourself every day what you're capable of.
Yeah.
Right? And if you're always taking the easier, softer way, if you're always taking the most convenient path through life, it's the path of least resistance. But again, in like muscle building, you know, if there's not enough resistance, you don't build muscle.
But you know, regarding that that thought, like that moment when you went to that tapas place with that hostess, you know, younger. But, you know, because I'm trying to put myself in your shoes now. So I'm on my way to that tapas place with that girl, right? And I'm thinking about another woman. But what, you know, so there is that thought that comes. But what made you feel, what made you certain that this thought was not madness, you know, like trying to escape or run away from that moment I'm having with the hostess right now? Like, how did you know which one is right? Do you know what I mean?
Because it was counterintuitive.
How?
Well, because I would tell myself, and a lot of the societal messaging for men and women is when given the choice between a young, nubile, 20-something hostess or a 43-year-old career woman I mean, what would you choose if they were both, you know, put in front of you?
Huh.
And on our first date, wow. My future wife and I, one of the first things she asked me was, you know, so how old are you? I'm in 40, whatever. And then she goes, well, why aren't you dating 25-year-olds? I said, it's because of dating 25-year-olds that you and I are sitting here right now. Right? Because the only way you know if something's not right for you sometimes is to get it and realize that that didn't fix you either. That wasn't the cure. That wasn't the answer. And you're still left with yourself. So I knew it might be something I needed to pay attention to because it was counterintuitive.
Yeah.
It's not what my usual choice would have been because she wasn't what I thought I wanted at, you know, at my age and time. And it was kind of those things that, oh, this goes against what I thought was my nature. This goes against what is the easier, softer, most palatable, acceptable path. And sometimes, you know, taking the road less traveled is much more rewarding because it took me on a path where I came into a life that was beyond my imagination. You know, in my early recovery, I just wanted like a job, an apartment, maybe a car that was the same color all the way around. I wanted to maybe, you know, have a couple beers on the weekend. This whole abstinence thing I thought was going way too far. But in working a consistent recovery program, my values changed. What became important to me changed. And often in the background that I wasn't aware of the change. So when I met this woman, that program that had been running in the background, you know, that was activated when I met her. And I thought, whoa, this is way better than what I thought I wanted. Right? But you don't know that. I didn't realize that until I went after what I thought I wanted, got it, and found that that wasn't it. When I opened myself up to what the universe actually put in front of me, instead of what I wanted for me, it went much better for me. Because again, I'm not that creative. I'm not that I don't have that kind of imagination, vision that could create, could predict the life that I have today. You know, to go from, you know, being a homeless, desperate, unemployed, you know, single alcoholic and drug addict at 40 years old to being, you know, the person I am today at 60 is, it's, I heard it expressed as alcoholic math. In the world outside of recovery, 2 and 2 equals 4. In the world of recovery, 2 plus 2 equals 37, because you can't, it's not a linear path to go from where I started to where I am now. It's almost impossible to imagine all the things that needed to happen. And yet here I am, and it seems very natural that for the amount of effort that I put in, what I've gotten from recovery is so much more than I deserve. And that's one of the things that makes me realize that this is a divinely inspired program, that it allows us to access a power beyond ourselves that can give us a life beyond my wildest imagination. And it's pretty neat. You know, all I had to do, and I say that facetiously, but really, one of the most important things I had to do was to let go of my old ideas of what it means, what masculinity means, right? What does that even mean, right? For me, masculinity is being secure enough in who I am as a man that when I was living in Singapore and somebody asked me, oh, what do you do? I could say with complete confidence and lack of any artifice or anything else is, oh, I'm a homemaker. And it wasn't easy the first couple of times I said it because, I mean, you know, we're in Singapore. All these guys are suited and booted. And, you know, we have the masters of the universe, you know, among us. Mm-hmm. We lucky few mortals. But when somebody comes at me with that kind of energy and I said, well, I'm a homemaker. You know, that what does it take more balls to say? That I'm a hedge fund manager? That I'm, you know, doing this or that? Or that I'm a homemaker? Mm-hmm. You know, I got the cojones because I am confident in who I am. I'm unapologetic because they don't know what it took, the journey I was on to get here.
Yeah.
I do. And so no, I know my value. I know my place in the world. You know?
Yeah.
It's like I used to be like, you know, we're pushed to be the best. Mm. And in my family, we're pushed to be the best, right? Mm. But for me, if I couldn't be the best at something, I was equally satisfied by being the worst because it's feeding my ego. Mm. I'm either the best on top or I'm on the bottom because the worst place to be is in the middle. That's boring, you know? That's not worthy of who I am, what I think I am. And again, it's just not having to be, you know, above everyone or below everyone. It's just being in the middle. That's really where I belong. But it's funny because I've heard that, you know, alcoholics, addicts were the only people that could look down at you from the gutter, you know?
Yeah.
Because even though you're the lowest of the low, at least you're not them,
mm-hmm.
right? At least you're not in the boring middle. And that's just such a crock of shit.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You know, it's interesting when you mention masculinity, what it means to be a man. Because, yeah, you know, the way I grew up, I don't see any model that shows me that being a man is loving my wife, making coffee for her in the morning, preparing dinner for her later, being a homemaker, you know. And how did you create this thing? Did you see that written in a book? How did you come up with it? How did you find it, you know?
You know where that came from? Because I'm creative and I have a lot of love to give, right?
Yeah.
I didn't have any role models for that. I had to create that person.
Mm.
You know, one day at a time.
Yeah.
1 hour at a time. Because the thing was that it worked. You know, drugs and alcohol used to work until they didn't. And then I tried recovery for a while and it didn't work. But I kept at it and kept at it and kept at it until it did. And again, I came to that place because I had no other choice. I had to find a way to create a life worth living that was outside the bounds of what is normally considered successful, what is normally considered as, you know, being a man, or what it means to be of service, what it means to love and to be loved.
Mm.
And a lot of that was letting go of old ideas and creating a world. Did you hear that? To create a world that I could have value in, that I could bring something to the table that was unique to me and to my situation, that I was doing something that nobody else is capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm here. And so by doing that, by not working a conventional job, mm-hmm. by putting other people's needs first other than my own, again, I got what I needed. I didn't always get what I wanted, but I always got what I needed. And that's true before recovery and since recovery. You know, my sponsor would tell me, you know, was there ever a time in your drinking and using? And I started at 16 and ended at 40, right? Mm-hmm. 24 years. Was there ever a time in those 24 years that you couldn't get what you wanted? And I told him 8 days. 8 days in 24 years. 5 days I was locked up in a jail in the Bahamas, which is another story. And 3 days that I was in a hospital for treatment, right?
Mm-hmm.
8 days out of 24 years, I would say that, you know, there was a higher power working in my life to mm-hmm. make sure I got what I needed. And my sponsor said, in recovery, have you ever spent a night without a roof over your head or without enough food in your belly?
Mm.
I said, no. So he said, what you're telling me is that in your life before recovery and since recovery, there's always been a higher power working in your life. I said, that's what the record, my experience would show. He said, and yet you act as if that higher power won't be there tomorrow.
Mm.
You've got 40 years of proof that it's always been there.
Yeah.
Yet you doubt that that same thing, that same power in the universe that is taking care of every need won't be there for you tomorrow. And that's, yeah, that's, it's embarrassing to say, but yeah, that's how I felt.
Mm.
You know, that's how powerful that fear, that lack of faith, that lack of trust was. And when that was identified to me, I kind of did a 360. I kind of leaned into that.
Mm.
I acted as if tomorrow, that higher power that's been sustaining me the whole time will be there tomorrow.
Mm.
And it was a very difficult transition. But you know, the more I do it, that's how you move into that space. You move from believing in a higher power, like that concept in your head, to trusting that higher power. They say the furthest distance is that 12 inches from your mind to your heart is the farthest distance you'll ever travel. And some people never get there. You know, it just remains abstract concepts. But, you know, doing those things every day in recovery, it helps move those concepts from here to here and then out there in the world, because that's where we live, actually. You know, we exist in the world. So how are we to conduct ourselves, you know, in the world? And that's what the program gives me the ability to do. It gives me the ability to align my actions with my intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've always had the best of intentions, but I haven't always been able to act on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in active recovery, I would disappoint myself and disgust myself on a regular basis. That's where that self-loathing comes in. In recovery, I'm more able to align my intentions with my actions, mm-hmm. esteemable acts, building, and so that it's inevitable. They say that, you know, if you work this program to the best of your ability, you're going to have a spiritual experience whether you want one or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the actions that you take that will build and create the results that you receive.
Mm-hmm.
I became a drug addict and an alcoholic against my will. That's not what I set out to do. But years of what is using against your will look like when you wake up, or in my case, come to, fear filled with loathing and disgust from the events of the night before, and you promise yourself you're not going to do it again.
Mm.
And as the day wears on and it gets dark, you get bored, you don't have a solution, you don't know what to do. So you go end up doing what you've always done, hoping that this time the result will be different. That's one of the definitions of insanity, right?
Yeah.
And I think that I got into recovery and I got sober against my will. I didn't think that I could do it. I didn't think it was possible.
Mm.
I didn't even know to want it because I knew it wasn't for me.
Mm.
But I kept taking the actions that were suggested to me by people in recovery. And by taking those actions on a consistent basis, it didn't matter what I thought, what I felt, what I believed. I kept doing those things and I got sober.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of myself, whether I wanted to, whether I believed it or not, I kept taking the action, and that was the result I got.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, because you brought it up, you want to talk about the Bahamas story? What happened?
The what story?
Being locked up in the Bahamas?
No. No, no, that's another podcast.
All right, sorry. No, yeah, no. So we're going to end now, but thanks a lot, Arnold. Just just before we stop the episode, just wondering, you know, for anyone, you know, watching this, you spoke about masculinity and like maybe men, young men struggling, you know, with or without any, you know, like booze or, you know, drug problem. Is there anything you want to tell them?
You are a beautiful child of God, and you are absolutely perfect the way you are today in this moment. Like it or not, buddy.
Thanks a lot, Arnold.
All right, thank you.
That was awesome. Thank you.
All right.
And Kurt, I think that's it. Merci.